The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour. Je voudrais vous joindre ma voix à celles qui vous ont déjà souhaité la bienvenue au Canada et à Toronto. Welcome to Canada, to Toronto, and to this important session. My name is Joanne Chetta. I work for the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network, a human rights organization here in Toronto. Universal access as a rallying cry has highlighted in policy circles the need for scaling up of all elements of the response to HIV/AIDS, HIV testing included. In many countries, as we all know, only a small percentage of people living with HIV know their HIV status, and this is a matter of urgent concern. In the early years of HIV, there were at times many calls for mandatory HIV testing, as well as for criminalization of people living with HIV and other measures that were driven by fear of this new disease. It was understood quickly by AIDS activists that protecting the privacy of those who would be tested for HIV and helping them to understand HIV and the HIV test before they had the test might be the only means possible to encourage people to seek testing. Unfortunately, we're competing with a little noise next door. We'll try to ratchet up the volume. The approach to HIV testing adopted by most jurisdictions and recommended by the World Health Organization up to now, usually known as voluntary counseling and testing, VCT, embodies a concern for the rights of those living with and affected by HIV that is manifested in what some call the three C's. Consent that is informed and specific to the test, confidentiality of test results, and counseling before and after the test. These elements, again, were a response to the pervasive stigma, demonization, and criminalization of people living with HIV and many of those at risk. This VCT approach is also characterized by the test generally being initiated by a request from the person to be tested. We are, as you all know, at a time of potentially momentous change in international policy thinking on HIV testing. In recent years, influential clinicians, AIDS policy specialists, and veteran AIDS activists have called for a different policy approach that would put greater emphasis on the initiation of HIV testing by health service providers. Provider-initiated testing approaches embody a gamut of policies and practices which have come to us with what is sometimes a confusing array of terms. The routine offer of an HIV test to people in some circumstances, especially in health facilities, and particularly to pregnant women, has been advocated widely and is now the official policy of a number of countries. The degree to which this routine offer allows for the possibility of pre-test counseling and a process of informed and specific consent is not always clear either in the statement of the policy or in the playing out of the policy in reality. Some have called as well for what is often referred to as, or sometimes referred to as, routine testing. That's not the same as routine offer, by which people, again, in certain circumstances, would be tested for HIV unless they opt out of testing. Proponents of provider-initiated testing have made many arguments in its favor. Many have said that voluntary counseling and testing has simply failed. It has not proven rapid and efficient enough to be adequate to the urgency of the need for testing, particularly as treatment for HIV disease, as well as procedures for the reduction of mother-to-child transmission, have become more available. They have sometimes suggested that making HIV testing more routine will have the effect of reducing the stigma faced by people living with HIV. Some have suggested that in high prevalence areas, there is already enough awareness of the disease that pretest counseling may not provide enough marginal benefit to justify the high cost of having adequate trained counselors available in all testing services. They have even at times accused those who continue to advocate for voluntary counseling and testing of standing in the way of effective AIDS responses. It was suggested by several speakers already in this conference that universal access goals will not be achieved without human rights-based approaches. Stigma, criminalization, and human rights abuse of people living with HIV and populations that are vulnerable are unfortunately alive and well. Indeed, criminalization of HIV transmission and exposure seems, as a matter of law, to be increasing in many countries. Those whose daily work has to do with the protection of the human rights of those who stand most directly in the path of this epidemic have raised questions about the wisdom of abandoning the human rights protections that have been part of HIV testing policies up to now. More generally, there are questions of practice and practicality that are raised in this discussion. How are routine offers experienced by people, including by people already fearful of health services? In places where there are educational and class differences between health providers and those using health services, is opting out of an HIV test really feasible? What if making HIV testing routine means fewer opportunities to understand who is most at risk of adverse outcomes of disclosure, including violence and abuse? Are there experiences where VCT or provider-initiated approaches have been well analyzed for their effectiveness and cost-effectiveness, not only with respect to the indicator of testing uptake, but with respect to reducing stigma, abandonment, violence, and other possible adverse outcomes of disclosure of HIV status? We have a remarkable group of experts today to help us flesh out this discussion. They include three persons working in Botswana, a country that has an emerging nationwide experience in provider-initiated HIV testing, as well as others who have been close to these issues from experience in other venues and in the world of human rights. Because there are so many speakers, I will, alas, have to be ruthless with timing of their interventions at 5 minutes, I think you all know, and do that in the interest of allowing some possibility for questions from you at the end. I will give very brief introductions of our speakers and invite them in the limited time they have to elaborate on introducing themselves if they care to do so. Without further ado, it is my honor to present to you the first speaker, who is the Honorable Minister of Health of Botswana, Sheila Klo, who has been Minister of Health since 2004. Madam Minister.
Thank you very much. As you stated, I'm a new Minister of Health. You are actually timing me. Okay. I'm a new Minister of Health, but before I became Minister of Health in 2004, I was an HIV/AIDS activist. In fact, a gender and AIDS activist, trying very, very hard to ensure that women's voices are heard. So I formed the Society for Women and AIDS in Africa and was actually, participated in a lot of policy issues that the government had put in. So without much ado, let me see where I am. The background, you're going to have to read fast because I'm not going to repeat. So there's the background. The problem was simply that despite a very good public healthcare system and services being put in place, there was very low uptake. So we had to sit down as Botswana and we had a national stakeholder conference on testing where a lot, you know, all stakeholders participated, including myself as representing Society for Women and AIDS in Botswana, but also the Coping Center for People Living with AIDS, which is a grassroots organization for people living with HIV, as a member of the, as a chair of the board. Now, rapid testing, so routine testing therefore was introduced, but look at the last two bullets. It's routine offer of testing with an opt-out approach. It's provider initiated, but it was also accompanied by rapid testing. So I'm hoping that I'm clarifying quite a few things. Right. Okay. The objectives are there. It was simply to make a public health, you know, to facilitate access to prevention, care, treatment, and support systems in the country. And most importantly, hopefully, to bring down stigma. So you have all those, and those are the services that are on offer in Botswana. Now, the indications were those, but anybody really who wanted to test, who asked for a test, could have it. There are the results. If you look, you'll see that 2004, between the return effort, we don't even have numbers. But 2005, after that, we had 177,000 people who were offered the test, and of these, 157,894 accepted, which is like 89%. Now, this is a big number compared to 80,000 for voluntary counseling testing centers. So that it was a really high uptake. Now, the next thing, that is what I want to dwell on, because people talk human rights. Now, what we did, that's before I became a minister, I worked with Physicians for Human Rights. And we, 11 months after this policy was introduced, 11 months, we went into the countryside, 7 districts, and found out what are Botswana's experiences. So, as you can see, most of them felt they had done their own decision, they had not received any ill treatment, confidentiality was maintained, not threatened by a partner, and yes, there was free education done. Post-test counseling, the numbers are 90%, which is kind of down, but then it's because some people don't come back for their results. So indeed, it was great that a lot of them would encourage others to test. And in that sample, which was over 1,000 people, the level of testing was actually 48%, which is pretty high. In fact, Botswana has one of the highest testing levels, I'm sure, nationwide. So conclusion, routine testing works, and it is highly acceptable. As you have seen. However, and we've had very high uptake, but that uptake has actually helped us. If you look at maternal PMTCT, our uptake is 91%. We've seen reduction of mother-to-child transmission go down from around 30% to where it's now around 6%. So that's really a plus. ARVs, about 70% of our people have access to ARVs. Those who need them. In fact, WHO says 85. I kind of like the WHO figure. It puts us higher, but we think it's anyway at least 70. But however, the caveat in my last 30 seconds is to say that you need aggressive training of healthcare workers on policy, on human rights, and on public education. This is the cornerstone to its success, and that's what we are trying to do in Botswana. Thank you very much. I still have 16 seconds.
Madam Minister, your example that you've set with respect to time is admirable. We are pleased to have with us also from Botswana, Grace Sidyo, who is a project officer of the International Community of Women Living with HIV/AIDS in Gaborone.
Thank you. Well, as a woman working for the International Community of Women Living with HIV and also coming from the Network of Women Living with HIV in Botswana, my point of view, I wouldn't actually encourage other women to test because there are so many issues that face women in Botswana after they learn their HIV status. Recently in Botswana, politicians and opinion leaders have put the blame for spreading HIV squarely with women who get pregnant knowing that they're HIV positive. And it also seems that PMTCT was conceptualized for women who are ignorant of their status, but that those who are pregnant after knowing that their status, either by choice or not, are being publicly accused to be infecting their partners. That is, gender inequalities is there. Bias of routine testing towards women because women are available in health facilities, particularly in the antenatal services. I think from a perspective view of a woman living with HIV, government should have, they should move away from seeing this as a collecting data, not human rights-based approach healthcare system. Opt-out approach by Botswana government is difficult for women who may not be empowered to refuse a test in order to consult with partner, that is the father of the unborn child, or simply because they are not psychologically ready to test. Culturally or socially, women in Botswana are having difficulty to refuse a person in a position or in a position of power. Once tested HIV positive, women, of course, receive material support, that is ARVs and formula, after the baby is born, but there is a definite lack of social and emotional support, especially to facilitate this social to partner and family. This also has an impact on adherence to formula feeding and returning of mothers with their children for HIV testing of child to facilitate treatment of the infected children. Here we find a problem of stigma. As a person living with HIV, I ask myself, what would cause the government of Botswana to establish a routine offer of an HIV test in the public health system with the necessary comprehensive support? Botswana should be in a position to increase its coverage of voluntary testing and counseling facilities all over the country, and make use of the many civil society initiatives, many of which are run by people with HIV, which could offer quality counseling and testing. As a person who had to accept her HIV status, I know that it is important to be ready to know one's status in order to live positively. People who are unprepared to get an HIV diagnosis find it difficult to accept all the realities that come with such diagnosis, which ultimately will have an impact on the adherence to treatment. And of course, we all know that if you don't adhere to HIV treatment, you have some difficulties. You end up being labeled drug-resisting patient. You have all the difficulties. So I think I wouldn't agree that much with the routine testing. Thank you.
Christine Stegling is the director of BONELA, the Botswana Network on Ethics, Law, and HIV/AIDS in Gaborone. We're happy to have you, Christine.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. The third person from Botswana. Honorable Minister, thank you for giving a presentation on what we are we have introduced in Botswana not so long ago. I'm going to talk a little bit about our perspective as civil society on our routine provider-initiated opt-out routine testing. I think all of us agree that testing for HIV is a starting point for any intervention, maybe prevention, care or support, including psychosocial support and access to antiretroviral treatment. All of us agree to this, and all of us agree that it is crucial that as many people as possible have access to HIV testing and actually make use of testing facilities. What we don't seem to agree on is how the test is initiated and what the process of testing should be. Unfortunately, this disagreement has been discussed in a rather polarized way, putting human rights activists at one end and public health practitioners at the other. It is as if we are saying that public health does not have to be understood within the context of human rights, be it at the level of the right to health or at the level of the right to information and the right to privacy. All of these rights are interlinked and ultimately contribute to well-informed citizens making intelligent choices about their lives, looking after their health, and therefore contributing to the well-being of our communities. As human rights activists in Botswana, we found it highly regrettable that we are portrayed as obstacles to public health, as people who have made HIV an exceptional disease. In actual fact, while we still believe that HIV is not like any other disease, many of the principles that we are arguing for, such as the right to informed consent, the right to privacy, and the right to be protected from discrimination, can and should be applied to the treatment of all diseases. We assume that health practitioners do not perform any procedure or any test without engaging with their patient about the need and usefulness of such a procedure or test, and that same would only be undertaken once the patient has agreed. It is in this spirit that initially the Botswana Network on Ethics on HIV/AIDS agreed to the routine offer of a test, thinking that this could have happened a long time ago and it should happen as long as people give informed consent to such a test. However, in the current setup, it seems doubtful that patients understand their right to opt out of an HIV test, considering power imbalances between healthcare workers and ordinary citizens and public health facilities. The lack of information about the right to opt out of testing, of the testing procedure, also became apparent during a recent research that was undertaken for the National AIDS Council with regard to laws in Botswana. The researchers noted that it is regrettable to note from discussions we had with key informants that it emerged that public health practitioners do not, in general, do enough to inform patients about their right to opt out of routine testing. It seems that the missing link in the many debates about testing is the discussion about the societal context that testing takes place in. HIV-related discrimination does happen, and to this day, Botswana has not enacted any legislation that protects the rights of those infected with HIV. As an organization, we run a legal aid clinic with an attorney providing legal assistance to those who have experienced such discrimination. It is a distressing reality that each day we see about two clients that complain about unfair dismissal, refusal of employment, and unfair treatment at the workplace. In actual fact, Botswana has a Court of Appeal judgment that pronounces it legal for employers to test for HIV as a prerequisite for employment, and that may be the decision of the employer not to employ HIV-positive applicants. This decision has not been challenged in the courts, and we have not enacted any legislation to counteract it. There are other parts of our legislative framework that question whether we have created an enabling and protective environment for those living with the virus. For example, Botswana has adopted the concept of shared confidentiality, which severely limits and at times violates a person's right to privacy. And as so many other countries, we have not enacted any laws that protect women from domestic violence or marital rape. Why am I saying all of this? Would my argument be that if such protection and anti-discrimination legislation would be in place, I would agree with HIV testing without informed consent? No, I would not.
Can I have an extra minute?
No, I would not, because I believe that people should be part of the decision-making process of their healthcare, because it is only when we assist people in becoming agents of their own destiny in an environment that protects and respects their human rights that we will make a real change to the HIV epidemic in Botswana. Yeah. Perhaps in conclusion, we should ask ourselves, testing to what end? Do we have evidence that people who have not been consented to their HIV test actually live positively, protecting themselves from reinfection or infection, going on therapy and adhering to it? Is knowing your HIV status synonymous with positive behavior change and seeking care and support? It seems that recently people have engaged in a number game, pointing at the increase in testing but not qualifying such numbers with data about the actual impact that this has in terms of turning the epidemic around. I think we need to understand that unless we make human rights principles an integral part of delivering healthcare services, we will not be able to reach universal access for all. Thank you.
Oops. Sophia Gruskin is director of the Program on International Health and Human Rights at Harvard University and associate professor of health and human rights in the Department of Population and International Health at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I think I want to start by saying that I think all of us actually want to stop this epidemic, and we want to do this with maximum efficiency, but also with sufficient attention to people's well-being and security. And in terms of HIV testing specifically, this means from both a public health and a human rights perspective, focusing on why HIV testing is carried out, how it's being carried out, and whether in the ways in which it's being carried out, people actually understand the implications of their results and can access treatment. Now, the fact that treatment is finally starting to become more readily available implicitly means that testing has to be scaled up. But HIV testing is increasingly distorting some of the central issues in access to treatment. And unfortunately, many of these efforts to scale up are being framed in such a way that they look like they're pitting public health goals against human rights norms. It's time for the debate to be recentered onto something that actually moves us forward towards sound public health and human rights practice, and away from framing these as divergent and even antagonistic concepts. So with this in mind, I'd like to suggest 4 points. The first is that we pay attention to language and to acronyms. And this isn't only about semantics. It has critical implications. The language of routine testing is vague. It doesn't clarify if the testing is routinely offered or routinely imposed. And it means we need to be mindful in each case of actually what's being included when the language of routine testing is put out there. One more language issue. There's quite a difference between the acronym VCT and TC as an approach. And while the change in acronym may seem to be subtle, it opens up a range of questions about how strategies are being done. And that's not to say that VCT, as traditionally understood, is the only way, but it's actually incomprehensible to me why it is that if testing, HIV testing, is done within a health facility, that informed consent is no longer thought to play the central role that it should normally in health practice. It's quite a difference, if I can say, between the way we talk about health practice and veterinary practice. Now, the second point I'd like to make is about why the testing is being done. And is it so that the numbers that are being put out can be reported to governments and to donors on the numbers of people being tested look high enough that it looks like something is being done? Or is it so that people can actually know their status and can access treatment? From a rights perspective, there's an obligation to ensure that if testing is performed, access to care and treatment has to be not only a theory, but a duly implemented practice. The third issue, how is it that we talk about the examples of where HIV testing policies are changing drastically, in particular where these changes are taking place with little say on the people who are actually being subjected to this conference, to this testing? At this conference, San Francisco and Lesotho, as well as Botswana, are being cited, and at times erroneously so, as examples of similar sorts of routine testing. Policy directives that provide for the routine offer of testing with informed consent is quite different from systematic testing with an opt-out policy. This is no defense of any one of these policies. It's just to say we have to look and be much clearer about the content of what's actually within these in each case. What's the content of the pretest counseling? What does the consent look like? What form does encouragement to be tested take? Now, the fourth point is that how these policies are written is one thing, but how they play out is quite another. Think about a routine testing policy with generalized language that pays little attention to gender differentials and to vulnerable populations. Even with decent language, the policy is going to play out very differently when an employed middle-class man comes voluntarily to a provider's office for another health issue and the test is offered and explained. And I would suppose the opportunity for rational decision-making offered, as well as time given for post-test counseling and the provision of results. Think about the same policy as it might apply to a poor woman in the context of pregnancy and childbirth, in particular around delivery. And and the issues that might arise about whether and how consent is assured, the ways in which counseling pre and post are provided, and how the woman will be informed of a positive test result, as well as the confidentiality of that result, let alone the links to the services and to treatment that may exist not only for the infant, but for the woman herself once she's through the process of pregnancy and childbirth. Now, in conclusion, we need to ensure that decisions on approaches to testing are made with full attention to community concerns and within communities. And we need to be sure that evidence is collected about the effects of these policies and the practices that they generate in ways that are systematic and comparable. We have to be careful that those that are responsible for implementing and evaluating these policies pay enough attention not only to the hoped-for outcomes, like the decreases in stigma or the normalization of HIV or the strengthening of health services, but also the adverse outcomes, such as the increases in stigma that a person may experience, the violence that they may experience if their test results are known, as well as a number of health activists at this conference are making clear, the burdens that can be placed on our already strained health services if they are not fully equipped to handle increased need and demand. The need to scale up is clear. The history of AIDS, we've been through many issues that are divisive. I don't think that there's any doubt, actually, that these different approaches are well-intended, even if often they're misguided. But we have to be sure that policies and practices are sound in both public health and human rights terms, not only for moral and legal reasons, but to be effective. It's time to deliver, sure, but it's time to deliver right. Thank you.
Mark Haywood directs the AIDS Law Project in Johannesburg, South Africa. He's also the National Secretary of the Treatment Action Campaign and the chairperson of the Law, Ethics, and Human Rights Task Team of South Africa's National AIDS Council.
That's a little bit out of date, but we'll forgive Joanne for that. Good afternoon. I'm a human rights activist, but I'm going to spend the next 5 minutes speaking to you as a public health activist. And I can do so because I believe that human rights and public health should not be at odds and are not at odds on this question of scaling up HIV testing. I'm going to suggest an approach that is different to the approach that has been adopted by Botswana, even whilst I respect the motivation of the government of Botswana for dramatically trying to increase the numbers of people who know their HIV status. On June the 26th last year, a friend of mine called Ronald Lowe, who was a law lecturer at, in KwaZulu-Natal, died of AIDS. His death prompted Edwin Cameron, a well-known human rights activist, to start to propose that we need to fundamentally change the approaches that we have worked with around voluntary counseling and testing. Edwin Cameron argued, perhaps correctly, that Ronald would not have died if a doctor or a medical practitioner had offered him an HIV test rather than depending upon Ronald overcoming his personal fears and stigmas to request that HIV test. On that basis, Cameron suggests a total shift of paradigm, saying that the benefits of HIV testing now fundamentally outweigh the risks of HIV testing, and on that basis, we can largely do away with the principle of informed consent and with the requirements of pre-test counseling. I disagree with Edwin Cameron. I believe that Edwin Cameron, again, even whilst his motivation may be just, is proposing something that is dangerous and which is a shortcut and which will lead us into a very difficult situation. I want to argue that the advent of access to treatment has in fact changed things dramatically. And very quickly to show you some facts, and it's not often that you hear me praising South Africa's response to HIV, but if you look at these facts here, you can see a dramatic increase in VCT, at South African health facilities in the context of access to treatment, as dramatic as that that was shown to us by the government of Botswana. If you look quickly at this slide, this is a district in a place called Ekurhuleni, just outside Johannesburg. You see in the course of 1 year a similar dramatic increase in the numbers of people being counseled and the numbers of people being tested. But if you look at this slide, you see that the increase in access to taking and uptake of taking also reveals some of the weaknesses. Low VCT training rates of healthcare workers. Despite high HIV positive rate in health facilities, systems for ongoing follow-up of clients were often lacking or weak. Those are the things that should ring alarm bells to us, and those are issues that should concern us as much as the question of increasing the numbers of people who know their HIV status and who are tested for HIV. So I want to conclude by making some general points and some specific recommendations. The first point is that a lot of this debate takes place on the back of anecdote rather than sound science, which should be a matter that concerns us at a scientific conference. There's a terrible vacuum or lack of information about monitoring HIV testing and assessment. Second point, there's a lack of investment in testing, in the promotion of testing and in counseling across the board. I can't illustrate that. Third point, we incline to blame voluntary counseling and testing for low uptake in the past, but it's not voluntary counseling and testing. The problem has been the lack of access to voluntary counseling and testing, and very often the lack of incentive to voluntary counseling and testing. The fourth point is that HIV testing is a human resource issue as much as it is anything else. In the South African health system, it's estimated that 60,000 people provide informal health services to the public health system. And most of those people provide counseling and testing services. We've got to formalize that resource basis. So in conclusion, I would argue, yes, we do have to scale up HIV testing. The time has come for a dramatic increase in the numbers of people who know their HIV status. But we have to do so in a fashion which continues to respect people's autonomy, which continues to respect people's dignity. Because after all, and this is where human rights and public health come together, what is counseling for? Is counseling a luxury, a human rights imposition, or is it a necessity to help people with issues such as disclosure, with living with a life-threatening virus, with adherence to treatment, post an HIV-positive diagnosis, and so on and so on. Counseling is a medical intervention. It is not just a human rights imposition. Nearly finished. I think the issue that we need to debate is that we need to raise the standard of care of other diseases to the level of HIV, not begin to bring HIV down to the standard of care of other diseases, tuberculosis in particular. So in conclusion, what is the way forward? The way forward from my perspective would be for countries to move and the WHO to move to a policy of recommending routine offer and recommendation. So it's not neutral, it's directive counseling, but together with counseling, particularly in healthcare, inpatient healthcare facilities. But we can't rest with that, because if that is the approach that we live with, what we do is we catch people who are already ill with opportunistic infections, who are already visiting our health facilities, and we leave out a much larger number of people who are asymptomatic, who are vulnerable still, who may be HIV negative. So to focus on provider-initiated testing and counseling without other models and without urgency about expanding other models is a mistake. We need active promotion of testing outside of health facilities. We need to target people at risk of acquisition of HIV infection and the people at risk of transmitting HIV infection. We need to link HIV testing to prevention messages and to services, and we need to link it to prevention and treatment literacies across whole populations so that people enter health facilities with a knowledge of HIV infection, which is not what happens throughout most of the developing world at the moment. Thank you.
John Tiedstrom has been, as of just a few days ago, if I'm not mistaken, the executive director of the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS. He was, until very recently, the president of Transatlantic Partners Against AIDS, which focuses on AIDS in Russia and Ukraine, and I believe is retaining some level of that title as those two organizations plan a merger. John.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today. First of all, I want to associate myself with everyone who wants to avoid the trap of false choices, the false choice between public health effectiveness and human rights commitments. I think, like many of our speakers today, that we can avoid those traps, and we must. And I also want to echo what Mark said about the need to do more in terms of collecting information and analyzing that information. We can't be afraid of taking bold steps and experiments as we go forward. Indeed, I want to congratulate Botswana for what it has done, and other countries and other organizations and institutions that have pushed the envelope on testing, because they do so with the best of intent, knowing that the future is uncertain and knowing that we don't have the answers, but knowing that today the status and the situation is unacceptable. Probably like many of you, I was touched last night at the opening ceremony by the speeches of the keynote by the keynoters who spoke to us. I was disappointed that not one of them focused on the issue of testing, however. And in the era of time to deliver, we've got to include testing. I hope that by the time Mexico City rolls around, we have made a lot of progress on this issue. But if we haven't, I hope that the keynote addresses and other events at that important conference will devote more attention to the question of testing. Having said that, all of the keynoters made important contributions. Frike Iskander from Indonesia told of people, both rural and urban, who died in Indonesia on a regular basis because they don't know their status. Peter Piot told us about the dangers of fragmenting the policy response to HIV/AIDS. In an era in which 36 million out of 40 million HIV-positive people do not know their status, that is the biggest fragmentation of all, and we must correct it. Helene Gayle, who so brilliantly reminded us that we need to constantly push ourselves to move from ideology and irrationality to evidence-based research and rationality, effective policies and compassionate policies. We need to do more to collect the information, as Mark said, and to apply it in a way that guarantees the basic human rights and civil liberties of people infected and affected by HIV/AIDS. When Bill Gates, who has this brilliant way of reminding us that when we are facing increasing rates of new infection, but and our ability to ramp up treatment is nowhere near the challenge, he reminded us that reducing prevalence rates is the only way to ensure universal access. Prevention is key to that, and knowing your status is an essential component of effective prevention in any country or any locality. The question is not whether we scale up testing, but how. The question isn't when we do it, because the time is now. If we're going to be successful in our time to deliver, we must deliver testing too. The private sector, which I'm very proud to represent, and by the private sector I don't mean just our corporate members, but their employees and their families, has an important role to play in this battle. It's been interesting to become acquainted with many of our company members who in Africa, in Asia, in other parts of the world are pushing the envelope, doing new things on testing, being very proactive in promoting voluntary counseling and testing, doing so in an environment that includes quality treatment, care, and support, doing so not just for employees, but for their family members as well. These are exciting innovations and exciting fundamentals, foundations to build on, whether at the national level or at the subnational level. Addressing stigma in every one of these cases is absolutely necessary, and the Global Business Coalition does not condone any corporate HIV policy that requires pre-employment testing or that in any way discriminates against employees based on their HIV status. If we come across a company that has those types of policies or those gaps in their HIV policies, we work very hard to correct them and to fill the gaps. Proactive campaigns that encourage testing, whether based on provider initiated basis or not, are very important and very effective. And finally, the private sector has an important role to play because today many people decide not to get tested because of the process of testing itself with needles and blood tests and the like. Having affordable, quick, and accessible testing that is non-invasive is an important way in which the private sector can make a contribution, and we encourage the development of rapid tests that don't require blood, and we look forward to the wide accessibility of those going forward. Thank you very much.
I'd like to give the panel members the chance to respond to each other or to pose additional questions to each other. I wonder if Minister Klo would like to say a word about some of the presentations. Would you care to do that? You may do that.
Well, I would say, is this on? No. Okay. The points mentioned by my colleagues are, you know, points are worth considering. But the point is that in our situation, we had nobody to learn from. This is a country, you know, the size of Texas, with only 1.7 million people, very precious. And then, of course, 17% of them are infected with HIV. So, you know, it meant sitting down with, you know, all the stakeholders and really saying what's the best way forward. And, of course, we are learning as we go along. But definitely the routine at the VCT, much as we have expanded, it was the uptake. I have a slide that was showing the uptake. Every year since it started, it was very low. Whereas the routine, you know, the offer of, you know, and even people asking, I mean, here it was not even an offer. Some people actually go forth and ask. And in fact, from this study of the Physicians for Human Rights, accepting or asking for routine testing was related to being female gender. You see, our women, most of them, much as they're saying here they need empowerment, women are more literate than males in Botswana. The female literacy has always been higher. So that it was related to being female with higher education, more frequent healthcare visits, and of course, inconsistent use of the condom. So that then it enables. So otherwise, I think, I mean, we are learning, and I'm sure by Mexico, we'll be having something to report better. But for now, we are reporting that we are far ahead as far as meeting our MDGs.
Thank you very much. Some of the panelists have indicated that they would like directly to open the floor to questions, but I just want to be sure. Grace, are you okay? Would you like to add a word? You have a microphone to your right.
It's working? Okay. I think I would want to agree with our Honorable Minister when she says most of the people who know their status in Botswana cases are women. And what I'm saying is that I think now we are experiencing another level of stigma because of being a woman. And I'm saying there should be some comprehensive measures to try to involve more male than as it is for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are three microphones, as some of you have already.
Here's something to add. Whoever recommends this doing that for this year. Here's something to add.
No, I think, Minister, she is telling me that the government is doing that. But what I want to say, apparently she knows. We have been having issues that are saying women are spreading the virus. And my issue or my point of view is we are now we are going to interfere with the measures that the government are putting in place. For example, the PMTCT. If a woman is HIV positive and she is now being blamed for infecting the or for spreading the virus, she is going to decide to stay home. Not to, so that she won't be blamed, and she might get, or she might give birth to an infected child, which is now a drawback at the same time. So what I'm saying is, we need to move away from all those stigma that is related to women. Thank you.
Okay, we can see how vivid the debate is in Botswana right now. There are three microphones. We're going to hear from you sequentially, one, two, three. We have about 37 minutes by my accounting. While I'm thinking of it, I was asked to announce that outside the door, if some of you will be peeling away, there are copies that you're most heartily encouraged to take of the International Guidelines on HIV/AIDS and Human Rights, which are, of course, pertinent to this discussion. But please identify yourselves before giving your question. Please keep your questions as brief as possible and let us know if your question is directed to any given person. Microphone one.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Oratile Kitmoseki. I work for Bonella in Botswana as well as a human rights activist and educator. My question is directed at the Honorable MP, Professor Nem Mashiladro. And my question is to basically challenge the statistic that you raised that 60 to 70% of people in need of ARV treatment are actually receiving it. I think possibly that your statistic is probably based on the 3x5 targets that were set by Botswana as 60,000 people on treatment by 2005. I was recently at another conference in Botswana where your own epidemiologists from the Ministry of Health have noted that that is a grossly incorrect statistic, because it was one that was set back in 2000 or 2001 when the 3x5 was set. So I'd like you to basically clarify. I think it's actually grossly incorrect, to the point that it's probably more like 30% or 20% that those are on people who need ARVs are on treatment. And my comment would also just would be that maybe to question your motivation, I think as a country, I'm a Botswana and I'm a proud Botswana, but I'd like us to really question where we're going in terms of when we present about Botswana. Is it a public health interest or is it a political interest? Thank you.
Madam Minister.
Let me point out that before the advent of other countries taking ARVs, Botswana had already decided that we were going to offer people ARVs as early as 2000. So we did a study that had to estimate the number of people who are infected, as well as the estimation of the number who actually need ARVs. And the number who need ARVs was 110,000. As I'm talking to you now, we're close to 70,000. That's why I'm saying to us, it represents, I mean, our 3x5 target was 55,000. We met that long before 3x5. And our adherence levels, for your information, are more than 95% because of adherence counseling. So, yes, we are very much, and in fact, WHO puts us at 85% of the people who need ARVs. You can go into the Global Health Report, you'll find it there. But we estimate it's about 60 to 70%. So that those are the figures.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Hello.
Microphone,
and,
please.
And they can be supported. I have my colleagues here. I mean, the real implementers are here. So I'm talking as a very proud Botswana who used to be a human rights and gender activist, and who is now a minister, and therefore seen to it to the implementation of the very programs that I wanted the government to put in place.
Thank you very much. Please identify yourself.
Hello, my name is Donna Futterman, and I'm with the Adolescent AIDS Program in the Bronx, New York. And first of all, I really want to salute the work that Botswana is doing and taking a leadership role in really literally saving its country and its people. Yeah. And I think we all need to recognize that as we move forward in this, there are going to be many models. And I think one of the things that's so powerful that you spoke about is the need to evaluate and to understand what works, what can be improved, and where we're going. But I would like to make a few comments.
Briefly, please.
Okay. The first are two historical points. Number one, we invented this current model of counseling and testing when the antibody test was developed, before we had any treatment. The goal of counseling and testing was completely different then. Everything has changed in HIV except the counseling and testing model. The second point is that what I have seen is that it's not the people who don't want testing, it's the providers who are reluctant to offer it. I've worked for 2 years with healthcare providers in the Bronx. We gave a 5-minute pretest counseling thing. We doubled the rate of counseling and testing in these clinics, but it went from 10 to 20%, and that's nowhere where we need to be. And I think it's the providers who are not able to offer the voluntary counseling and testing. My experience as a doctor is that it's not the moment when you find out that you need the counseling. It's over the months and years of care that the counseling and engagement is crucial. And I just think we need to reframe where those resources go. Counseling is crucial to services, but extended pretest counseling is not the place that we need it in order to accomplish what needs to be happening. After 25 years of the epidemic, we still have 1/3 of the people in the United States who don't know their status. The model we have has not been adequate, and I just want to salute everyone on the panel who is really trying to re-examine this and keep it moving forward. And I think we all agree that the difference between human rights and public health should not be a division. We are a small part of the world that cares about HIV. We need to be united to work together, and I think that the elements that we must all bring to the table are clear on this panel. Thank you.
Does anyone care to respond, Christine?
Thank you. I think one of the things that we all agree is that in many ways and in many places, some of the models that we used before did not work. But I think the question is what we are suggesting now working? And is the indication that more people are testing actually an indication that people will know how, or that people can live with the knowledge that they were getting? I think all of us, like I was trying to say, when we introduced this idea in Botswana, initially we were all happy to think of a routine offer where people would consent to such an offer. And making people, giving people a tool into their hands to change their life around. I think the question is whether it is VCT, the model that we have used, or whether, and can that only be countered by opt-out approaches, or can we say, like perhaps some of us have suggested, a routine offer, which still gives people a chance to say no and identify what their needs are to make that decision, and perhaps look at the counseling that we have offered. If the counseling was the problem, and if we have counseled people away from testing, perhaps it's our chance to say, how do we change that counseling? So I think it's like we are polarizing this debate constantly between provider initiated opt-out and VCT. It doesn't mean that we cannot look at VCT and at other models of VCT. So I think we need to keep that in mind in our discussion.
Minister Clough, briefly.
Okay. Yeah, what she said about a provider reluctance is actually true. In Botswana, every month, we have a ministry get on the radio, and people call in to say how, to tell you feedback on how you're doing. We had that 2 months ago in the Minister of Health. And it was interesting that a lot of people were really praising us for, you know, enabling them to access, you know, ARVs to test, but they were saying, but minister, talk to your doctor, to your doctors and nurses. Some of them, just when you are expecting them to explain to you routine testing and offer it, they keep quiet. You have to now be an assertive person to be able to say, well, aren't you going to offer me, you know, any form of testing? So that's true. We need to also really make sure that the doctors and the nurses, I mean, after all, they are also human beings, to have that courage to be able to offer that test. Thank you.
Thank you. Microphone three, please identify yourself.
Yes, hello. My name is Rina Geibel, and I work for Save the Children in Eastern Southern Africa. I'd like if any of the panelists could comment on children's access to testing in the various models that we're debating, and any comments on age of consent within that. In the case of Kenya, for volunteer counseling and testing, it is up to the counselor if a child under the age of 18 is of a mature status to go forward with a volunteer counseling and testing session. So if anyone can comment on
a thorny issue, would someone care to comment, Sophia?
Are I just speak? Okay, I'm just going to speak. I have a quick comment on that, but there's a longer conversation, which is I think there's incredible maturity in a young person coming forward and wanting to know their HIV status. And the fact that somebody comes forward in order to know their status means that they're responsible and therefore should be able to get their results themselves. So I feel quite strongly about that. I realize the question becomes, then who else has the right to be informed of those results? And my personal belief in that context is those people that young person who has been responsible enough to go to a provider to decides should be the people that they want to engage with.
A brief comment from Minister Ko.
Okay. In Botswana, because of our high uptake of PMTCT, we estimate that about 20,000 children who are HIV positive, and of these, 6,000 are on treatment. Now, of course, being on treatment, I mean, we know that we're on treatment, but we don't know what percentage this 6,000 it is of those who actually need ARVs, and it's simply because it's only now that we've introduced the dry cord blood test. Before, the child had to wait until they were like 18. So because of that, we have an idea of what's happening among the children.
Microphone one, Ian.
Thanks. I'm Ian McLeod. I work for UNICEF. My question was the same as our Save the Children colleague, but because Mark didn't get to answer, I wonder to direct the same question to Mark in relation to access of children and adolescents to counselling and testing, particularly in relation to the conflict between human rights, child rights, law and policy. Thank you.
Mark?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's a number of issues here. One is the larger issue of the fact that children are suffering in terms of access to healthcare services, access to HIV prevention services, access to HIV treatment services generally. I would think when it comes to very small children and infants, the need for parental permission, if there are parents, is all the more important and requires proper counseling to accompany that test if that child, if the child is diagnosed as positive, is going to receive the proper and necessary care. So again, I believe that counseling is linked to the health intervention in that instance. As far as adolescents are concerned, I mean, South Africa, for example, has recently changed its law to allow adolescents or children of 12 years and above to request and to give their own consent to an HIV test. I don't think that an adolescent or a child with mental capacity or capability who decides that he or she wants to test for HIV should be denied that HIV test. But again, I believe that if adolescents are accessing healthcare services, and in most cases they're not because we don't have decent healthcare services for adolescents, but if they are accessing healthcare services, counseling to prepare a person for an HIV diagnosis and to communicate necessary information for them remains both a public health and issue and a human right.
Microphone two, please.
Gretchen Rohde, public health doctor working in a number of countries, including Botswana. Just to follow up again on this question about access to testing for adolescents, if we could have a comment from the Honorable Minister of Botswana, what the current situation is for adolescents below the age of majority to get tested. And the second question is whether routine testing has reduced rural and urban disparities in access to both prevention and care for HIV.
Okay, thank you. I'll take the second one. whether routine testing has reduced. It is definitely has, because in the right now, all our hospitals, primary district, offer comprehensive HIV/AIDS care services, as well as expanding to the clinics, so that under local government, so since you've been in Botswana, you know what I'm talking about, we are now expanding to the clinics. And through our partners, such as AHAP, we have been able to have IDCCs in quite a lot of rural clinics so that people can have access. And I'm finding, you know, a real success in that there are no more funerals, to tell you the truth. The funerals have gone down, and indeed, the male wards are still the ones which are full, but the female wards, you find empty beds in there. The adolescent. The age of majority in Botswana is 18 up, but we are now looking at trying to reduce, and we're working with Bonela and the human rights people to say, you know, a 16-year-old should not have to bring that parent. Of course, in practice, a lot of people will attend to 16-year-olds, but really they are now doing it illegally, because we are still in the process of redoing the law to ensure that 16-year-olds can have access to that. But in terms of services at school, 16-year-olds have services at school, prevention, you know, as well as education and all that. Yeah.
Microphone 3, please.
My name is Tegest Gema. I'm the Associate Director of WHO HIV/AIDS program. Mine is not a question, but I just wanted to clarify the position of WHO and UNAIDS in provider initiative testing and counseling in clinical settings, because I see that there are some confusion. First of all, provider initiative testing and counseling is routinely recommending testing in high prevalence areas in clinical setting. And WHO and UNAIDS believe that testing and counseling serves as an entry point for treatment, prevention, and care. WHO and UNAIDS also believe that provider initiative testing and counseling should be implemented with respect to human rights principles, with informed consent, confidentiality for the test result, and appropriate counseling. We also believe in WHO and UNAIDS also believe that the patient had the right to decline the test once he is informed.
Thank you very much.
I know you want it, but I would like also to say that provider initiative testing doesn't mean that we are stopping client initiative testing. WHO and UNAIDS believe that VCT or client initiative testing should continue as another mechanism of testing together with provider initiative testing, which is going to take place in clinical setting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Microphone 1.
Florian Breitenecker, MSF. I want to tell you about the patient in Malawi who died of cryptomeningitis. And when we reviewed the health passport, we could find that this same patient had been seeking health services for a severe pneumonia just 2 months before and shingles just 3 months before. So the point is, of course, there is an urgent need to scale up provider-initiated testing, because there is a huge lack, but it still can be VCT. And this initiation of the provider has to be targeted. What we did in our projects is we developed a checklist for the healthcare worker to have sort of a guideline whom to refer for VCT, because it's just not feasible that everybody of 300 patients waiting would be counseled for going to VCT. I can invite you to see a poster tomorrow, the poster 171, where we introduce this checklist, which has really helped to increase referrals for VCT. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Microphone 2.
My name is Paul Purcell, and I work for an organization called Engender Health.
My first question is related to informed consent. I know we talked about it a little bit today, and I think, Sophia, you touched on it. Most of what I've seen in current policies and guidelines to do with routine authoric testing is it's not really well defined, and the criteria or elements to determine whether informed consent has been achieved or not is not really very clear as well. I would like all the panelists to share with us what they think is entailed in informed consent, and whether you are responsible for any country-level policies to do with VCT, whether that's adequately defined in your country guidelines. And my second question is, it seems that this is an initiative, or these policies to do with new approaches to testing are really geared more towards the needs of the general population and needs of already invisible populations such as sex workers, injection drug users, and men who have sex with men. Their needs are not going to be adequately addressed by these new testing paradigms. And I would like you to also share with us what you think the implications of this are for those already invisible populations.
There's a lot there, and I don't think we have time to hear from every single panelist, but would someone particularly like to speak to those questions? Mark?
I mean, speaking for South Africa, I think that informed consent is adequately defined in our national guidelines, but the problem is that it's not understood by healthcare workers in most instances. So there's a confusion that turns into a fear about how to obtain informed consent and what often is actually informed consent. We're not arguing that by still requiring informed consent that every person needs to be taken through a 45-minute pre-test counseling session. There will be different people with different levels of knowledge and understanding of their own risk of HIV and so on, that may make it possible to obtain informed consent in a matter of minutes for some people, but require longer periods of time for other people. But the essence of the definition must surely be that the person who is offered and recommended the test agrees to the test on the basis of understanding what implications that test has for him or her in a number of crucial respects. I think the issue that you point to about the danger of invisible populations being made more invisible and more at risk is a very, very real danger that hasn't been given proper consideration in this debate up to this point because of the very fact that many of those groups that you referred to do not access healthcare services because of fear of the stigma, because of the attitudes of healthcare workers, and therefore the disproportion in terms of inequalities of access to treatment and care will increase if this change in paradigm does not take into account all of these types of these factors.
Just to add one thing on that, which is also that one of the problems is in terms of the misinterpretation of policies that are at a level of generality, that they can also move beyond the healthcare setting. And in terms of vulnerable populations like injecting drug users and like sex workers, there's also the question about what the implications are for testing that would happen mandatorily on the street, that would happen in centers of immigration, in detention centers, and in prisons, where when the policy says routine, it doesn't clarify sufficiently that we're talking about within health settings, and that is something that is very much of concern.
Greg?
Greg Gonzalez from the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa and Cape Town. This is for Mark and Christine. As part of the trainings we do in human rights, we've gotten to see that there, in Tanzania and Mauritius, there's draft HIV legislation that potentially will criminalize HIV exposure or transmission. And that's in two places. And in these meetings, AIDS NGOs were saying, what about the rights of the uninfected? And so there's criminalization isn't only the crazy people and the moralists who are saying this. It's within our own community. Put that into the testing mix and talk about how legislative frameworks that are starting to enshrine criminalization or want to might, how testing is going to work through these sort of situations.
Well, I think Greg Gonzalez raises a very valid point. I mean, there's evidence in a whole number of countries, both of populations calling for criminalization of so-called willful HIV transmissions and of governments who are following the lead. The danger of routine offer of HIV
testing misapplied is that you get tens of thousands of people who in theory know their HIV status and therefore can be accused of willful transmission because they have been tested for HIV and there is a record of the fact that they've been tested for HIV. But in reality, the process of testing has given them no guidance on disclosure, no opportunity to internalize the implications of an HIV positive result, and has taken no consideration of the immediate social environment of that person. And given the fact that we're proposing routine offer primarily in clinical settings, what that means is that women will be tested more than men, and that the shift towards criminalization and further stigmatization is something that women will bear the brunt of. So it's another red flag that has to be considered as we try to find the correct way forward in this debate.
Christine?
I think just to add to that, I think the issues that Grace discussed about the recent calls in Botswana for women who know their HIV status and make perhaps a decision to have another child and go into PMTCT and being accused by politicians and by other opinion leaders that they are spreading the virus, that already points at a very dangerous direction of putting the blame with women. And I think that is one of the areas that we need to consider very carefully. As at Bonella, I remember we had calls by the police where people were saying, we know this woman is on PMTCT, but she's breastfeeding. Should we arrest her? So there's this kind of thinking. And I think which is why I was saying we need to take into consideration our societal context of which testing applies. So it's a whole area that all of us have to think a lot more deeply through and consider all the dangers that lie in wrongly applied, perhaps, routine testing.
Microphone one.
Isman from Indonesia. A short question to whoever have the answer. Question is, can we combine or mix the mandatory testing with voluntary testing? Why I ask the question is also short. We have 100,000 more, especially women going abroad, become a migrant workers. Several countries require HIV negative, so we must conduct the mandatory testing. But we also want to conduct the voluntary counseling testing. So, why? Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Who'd like to go for that one? Go ahead, Mark.
Just very briefly, I mean, I think it's a serious problem that any country still makes an HIV negative test a condition for employment or for immigration into that country, including obviously the United States. Is all I can say in response to that question is the approach that we are recommending in South Africa with the military, with the National Defense Force, is that there may be situations where I would not link mandatory and compulsory testing. If people have to be tested on a compulsory basis as part of processing for immigration purposes, then I think that there's a responsibility to make sure that that testing takes place with full informed consent, with counseling and with an understanding on the part of the person being tested of the implications of an HIV positive test result. That's all I would recommend on that.
Just to add one thing on that, which is to say that it's also the fact of knowing when you're putting the VCT strategy into place to be aware of the incompatibility of other laws and policies that may make people afraid to come forward, and to recognize that that's going to need to be built into that VCT strategy while that mandatory testing strategy is in place, and to work like crazy to try to get that mandatory testing policy, obviously, to get.
I'm going to take the privilege of the chair just to say that it seems that it would be an excellent thing for the Indonesian authorities to do, to try to broker meetings with some of these countries that are making this requirement that women entering the country be HIV negative, or to solicit the help of multilateral bodies toward that end. Microphone two.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Kumoisi Kwenu. I'm the director of the HIV AIDS department in the Ministry of Health, Botswana. I would like to affirm that what the minister said is factual and is accurate. It's part of policy as a technocrat. I would also like to add that as a country, we got the idea of routine testing. Firstly, we did, it was evidence-based. In 2003, we did a KBP in ANC settings of women who generally, we got to understand that over 90% of the women, the reason why they're refusing to, they're declining testing is because of fear. So then we had a stakeholders meeting where then we were trying to find out how do we then make more people to overcome this fear. And that's why the routine of up testing idea came about. We then went ahead and went all over the country. We had focus group discussions with the communities. Actually, the guidelines of routine tests were based on what they were telling us. They told us that this issue, for them, every time they go to a facility, they expect to be tested. So every time blood was drawn for full blood count or whatever, they thought that they were tested. So they then told us that this issue of us putting them in a small room for hours really puts more fear and they end up declining. So we should do something about that. And that's why the issue of routine offer came in. But realizing the human rights and also the need to education, we had pre-test education outlined. We did flip chart, we did everything, including the aspect that these women have a right to refuse. So every time we do group education, even individual education prior to testing. So all these women are informed before they actually offered a test. The issue of women and violence and human rights, actually PMTCT is designed for women in Botswana. We have a whole PMTCT package. First of all, like I said, the pre-test education with the right to decline. We also make sure that these women access treatment as early as possible if they're eligible. Mm-hmm. We also have psychosocial support for them, their families and their partners in both the IDs, infectious disease clinics, and in ANC settings through the support and help of civil society. Botswana Network of People Living with HIV AIDS, they have peer counselors in all these settings. And the Botswana Christian AIDS Organization, they have peer counselors there. They have counselors there to counsel these women and their families to provide them with supportive counseling.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
And we also, I'll wrap up in a minute. But we also
in less than a minute, please.
Yeah, less than a minute. But as a country also, we are not saying we are doing away with VCT. Actually, this year, we are expanding VCT through Global Fund to 6 CBOs to provide VCT on top of the 16 that we have in the country. I just wanted to clarify that. And we are reviewing laws in Botswana to actually protect those people who might be discriminated. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to allow that pass without comment. Microphone 3.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Banks. My business is laboratory services and ensuring their quality. In the Western world, about 70% of medical decisions are based on laboratory services, and competency level is in the literature is people who do some thousands of tests. So in that context and what has been said here, and I congratulate at least two of the speakers in drawing attention to the fact that laboratory testing and ramping up and all these things depends on good laboratory programs and services. So in the interest of time, perhaps I won't ask a question, but would perhaps ask people to draw this need for laboratory services into these types of discussions, because I can tell you that laboratory services in many, many of the countries we're talking about are not even poor, they're abysmal. And that's not because the people don't have good intentions or work with other people who are actually ordering them, but because there's no funding for those. So I would appeal for, in this type of forum, that laboratory services are put into the discussions, and I thank you very much for including them this afternoon.
Thank you. Can we go to microphone one, please?
Thanks. My name is Cynthia Rothschild. I'm with a women's human rights organization called the Center for Women's Global Leadership. Sophia, you noted very explicitly your concern, and I believe I'm using your language, about the adverse effects of scaling up when it's not done well. And you mentioned violence and other HIV and other human rights violations as a concern of yours. That's something that the women's human rights community is obviously particularly interested in. In fact, we just issued a report called Strengthening Resistance that looks at the links between violence against women and HIV. Sophia, would you be willing to say more explicitly what some of your concerns are in relation to violence against women, gender-based violence, and testing done wrong?
Briefly, please.
For the sake of time, thank you for the question. For the sake of time, I'll just say very quickly that there are issues that have to do with what occurs within the health setting. There are issues of violence that occur with disclosure, which need to be reconciled both in terms of the woman and her family and her community, and that interventions are needed at each one of these levels. And that, in fact, in terms of looking at violence, violence is an issue that needs to be studied much more closely and with a lot more attention in terms of what it actually means, not only from a human rights and a public health perspective as distinct, but about how they mutually reinforce each other. And that actually interventions that are put into place that look at the two together can actually be more effective.
Thank you. Richard?
Richard Elliott from the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network. I'm not entirely sure that it's really so clear that we're all in agreement about how we all value human rights in this process, even though I think we get a certain amount of lip service to it. I think it's unfortunate, for example, that the WHO actually didn't send anyone to be on the panel to speak to this issue, given that WHO is actually pushing for routine testing globally. And in a recent consultation that the WHO held about this very issue, there was a very strong resistance to the notion of routine offer. It was very, very clear that what the WHO was interested in was routine opt-out testing. That is a very different thing from routine offer. And why would we have such a problem, or why would the WHO or governments have such a problem with accepting routine offer rather than routine opt-out testing, unless there was a concern that people were somehow going to make the wrong choice if given the chance to get an HIV test? So to me, it actually belies a certain fundamental disrespect for human rights to move directly to a notion of testing people unless they should opt out. And at the national level, I wonder if the minister could comment on the Botswana situation. At one point, the policy documentation in Botswana explicitly said that informed consent to HIV testing was not required in a number of cases, including, for example, pregnant women. Well, if we really think that we ought to respect human rights in the HIV testing process, then why would we go to the point of actually having stated policy that says you can do away with informed consent in those situations? So I think we really need to challenge the notion that we can describe things as routine offer, as I've heard a number of times here in some of these comments, when what we're really talking about is routine opt-out testing, which I think does raise some very serious human rights concerns.
I don't know if I heard him right, where he said in a policy document in Botswana that says informed consent is not... No, we don't have such a policy. Our policy emphasizes informed consent with complete confidentiality. Yes.
I wonder if any of your other colleagues from Botswana might comment. There was a draft policy in Botswana at one point that expressly said in clause 5.7 that informed consent was not required in the event of pregnant women.
Ask them.
I think that is still the policy, and I think the guidelines that are used to train healthcare workers actually point out when you don't need informed consent, like you say, Richard. I think one of them is for pregnant women, one of them is for what else did come? Yes, that's what the guidelines still say. Perhaps our technocrats or bureaucrats can confirm it, but I think that is what we are working with at the moment.
We're talking about the written rather than informed. Yeah, it's, you know, it says written consent. Because a lot of us don't want, you know, because of experiences with text, people don't want to have to sign anything. So that we are talking written informed consent. But the routine informed consent is part and parcel of our policy. Yeah.
Okay. We have time, I think, only for one more question, I'm sorry to say. Catherine.
I thought it was important.
Please identify yourself.
Okay. Catherine Hansen, Center for HIV Law and Policy in the United States. I thought it was important to clarify a couple of facts and points of history about U.S. policy because I've heard it mischaracterized here and in other forums. First of all, that the suggestion that testing and these laws, the United States laws on confidentiality were adopted when there was no treatment is in fact patently untrue. New York's law and most of the other laws in the United States were adopted in the late 80s where PCP prophylaxis and aerosolized pentamidine and Bactrim were crucial forms of treatment, and for better or for worse, AZT was also available and was considered an important form of intervention. Second of all, the suggestion that there is any evidence whatsoever that counseling interferes with testing or is a barrier completely overlooks the data available in the United States where vertical transmission has virtually been eradicated, and yet the majority of states, including New York, offer informed consent. In other words, pregnant women are offered counseling and tests before they are tested. In fact, the majority of states do this. And what that has done is engage more women in care at a point where it's a hell of a lot better for them and their pregnancy and their babies than waiting till the point of delivery. I think it's one of the things that's important, an earlier commentator talked about that the problem is with healthcare providers, and I think that that's true, but I think it's counterintuitive to suggest then that the response to the problem with healthcare providers is to ignore the evidence in the states where there was a focus on providers and requiring them to give testing, and instead to take away a fundamental right to information before you are tested. And if the United States goes around and says, we don't have the resources in our healthcare system to ensure that counseling happens, our system is too overburdened. It does not bode well for the rest of the world.
Thank you. I do apologize to the rest of you. We have fairly strict instructions to end sessions on time. We're a little bit over. I want to thank this extraordinary panel for the articulate and well-informed ideas that were put forward. I want to thank you for your participation. Please carry forward these issues through the week. Thank you.